From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we'll learn about the history of Wisconsin's Latino communities with the author of the new book, Strangers No Longer. Then we'll explore the connection between science and the arts.
We need to be respectful of each other. And by learning science and how science works, we learn more about the world that we live in.
Plus, we'll learn about the American Ornithological Society's decision to rename some birds in a new episode of Chirp Chat.
This decision will not end racism or EDI issues within the birding community. It's not going to do that at all. But it is a step in the right direction, and I think it's a fairly significant step.
All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. Milwaukee is known for its celebration of cultures, with its wide array of cultural festivals and the many cultural centers that call the city home. But Wisconsin's record of welcoming newcomers has been spotty, and that history hasn't always been well documented. Sergio Gonzalez is a Wisconsin native and Latino historian who was dismayed to find that much of his culture's history hadn't been researched. So he went about fixing that. His first book, Mexicans in Wisconsin, explores the history of Mexican immigrants in the state. His new book, Strangers No Longer, explores the intersection of Latino belonging and faith in Wisconsin and how it informs our communities today. Gonzalez joins me now in studio. Sergio, thank you so much for being here on Lake Effect.
Thank you for having me.
So often when we talk about Wisconsin's Latino community, we talk about it in a couple key ways, as both a monolith and as a relatively new history, kind of from the 1990s onward. This book really dispels both of these notions. When do Latinos first start coming to Wisconsin?
Well, you know, the first recorded Latino, the one that we have historical record of, goes all the way back to the 19th century. But the large numbers of Latinos settling here really begins in the 1920s, when Mexican industrial workers were recruited to Milwaukee, Wisconsin, to serve as workers in tanneries, factories, and foundries. And in many ways, they were just kind of following the footsteps of the European immigrants who had preceded them. They were coming here as cheap, controllable labor. Oftentimes, they were brought as strike breakers without their knowledge. And so they had a really tough go of it trying to find a space to live in Wisconsin, trying to find work sites that paid them well, that treated them well. And it was not a very easy experience for them. Again, an experience that's very similar to other groups that had preceded them before.
One of the key words of this book is hospitality. And it's a word that you use in a kind of interesting way. When you say hospitality, what do you mean?
Well, you know, I think all Midwesterners have an understanding of hospitality. The way that it comes to us most is the idea of Midwestern nice, and every state has kind of its own version of it, whether it's Wisconsin nice or Minnesota nice. We like to think of ourselves as welcoming people. And I think in many ways, Wisconsinites have been welcoming to Latinos across the 20th century, but there are so many instances where Latino immigrants, migrants, and refugees have struggled to find a sense of welcome here. I like to think of welcoming as not just saying hello to somebody and bringing them into the table, but also offering them political power, social space, economic power as well. And so there's an entire field of study called hospitality studies that tries to understand the interaction between the person who is the in-group and those who kind of exist at the boundaries and kind of the conflicts, the tensions that arise when those out-group members try to become members of the in-group. And for the history of Latinos here in the state of Wisconsin, there has been a constant tension. We have moments of great community, of great collaboration between different communities, but also moments where there has been friction. And I think into the 21st century, we see that we're still working out a lot of those questions.
One of the ways that you describe this is the idea of the perpetual stranger, this idea that, I'll have you explain it.
Yeah. I mean, this is, for me, the framing of the book, of course, it's a question not just of Latinos arriving in Wisconsin, but how they've built community. And I look at the question of faith, specifically faith spaces and houses of worship. And within both the Old and New Testament, there's this constant evocation of the stranger and the obligation to the stranger, how Christians and Jews are supposed to welcome the person who exists at the gate. Now, the question, of course, becomes is if that person who is at the gate is consistently going to exist at the threshold of belonging? Will they ever have an opportunity to actually be a full member of the community? And so I'm interested in, you know, as the book of Ephesians says, how can people become strangers no longer in a community they've called home for 100 years? And as I kind of note in the book, there's really an unresolved question here in whether or not Latinos are full members of their communities here in Wisconsin. I think many Latinos would call themselves Wisconsinites. I certainly do. I was born and raised here in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. But there is a constant tension of feeling, do I completely belong and do people want me to be here?
As you said, in the book, you really explore this through the church's relationship with Latino communities, going back to when Latinos originally come to Wisconsin. How did churches, parishes initially welcome these new migrants?
Yeah, I love the beginning of the story because I think it throws a lot of us for a loop. We might think of this kind of a progressive history of Latinos arriving as very difficult at the beginning, and it gets better across the 20th century. But actually, perhaps the best moments of welcome, of integration, happened in the 1920s when Latinos arrive. They find a lot of friction in their workspaces and social spaces. They settle on the city's south side. But the place where they find a home is in their churches, specifically Catholic churches. And it's white Catholics on the city's south side, specifically at Holy Trinity Church, who open the doors and welcome into the pews these Mexican Catholics who are arriving into the city. And it's that shared sense of Catholicism, right? The shared faith that exists between the two groups, even if they speak a different language, they have different cultures, they have different ways of knowing this city, that they find a sense of communion, a sense of fellowship. And so some of the most robust senses of collaboration that happen among Latino newcomers and Milwaukeeans is in developing a Mexican mission chapel on 5th and National. And that building still exists here in Milwaukee in the Walker's Point neighborhood. Eventually, that church migrates into the Holy Trinity Church, and we now recognize it, of course, as Holy Trinity Our Lady of Guadalupe, which is really the heart of Latino Catholicism here in Milwaukee.
This relationship really does change through the decades. How do we see this evolve over time? When Latinos, of course, the communities that are here are also changing. We're getting new people in. But also the people who had been here initially are really have set down roots, have created communities. How does this relationship to the church change?
Yeah, well, I'm glad that you mentioned at the start of our conversation the fact that Latinos are not a monolith. And this is kind of represented in the different groups that arrive in Wisconsin at different points throughout the 20th century. So Mexican immigrants arrive in the 1920s. The group that follows them are Texas Mexican Americans. So these are American citizens who were born at the U.S.-Mexico borderlands. And they come to Wisconsin to do migrant work in the 1940s through the 1970s. Their experiences are very different because they're arriving in rural Wisconsin. They're here very much temporarily from the spring through the fall. And eventually, many of them settle here in places like Milwaukee, Madison, Kenosha, Racine. They're followed by groups like Puerto Rican industrial workers who are American citizens, but they're still treated like outsiders in many ways. They arrive here in Milwaukee as industrial workers in the 1950s. And then, of course, Cuban refugees in the 1960s and the 1980s, and Central American refugees who arrive in the 1980s who are fleeing persecution but find a limited sense of political harbor here in Wisconsin. And so all of these different groups, even though they fall under the large umbrella of Latino, Hispanic, Latinx, Latine, are having different experiences with the people who arrive here and different experiences with those established Latinos who have been here perhaps for decades before.
Now, your book explores how churches not only served as a place of worship, but also often a center for political and activist organization. How did that develop?
It was, I would say, very organic, and I think it's an experience that many people have with their churches. These are not just places of worship where they can pray to their Lord, where they can practice the scriptural teaching, where they can have a sense of community with people who are like-minded in their faith. It's also a place that can serve as a social service agency, a place of education, not just parochial schools, but, you know, people learning English. And then ultimately can also be a place for political empowerment and political mobilization. So there are different moments where this happens. Of course, in the 1920s, those first Mexican migrants who arrive here, some of them are political refugees who are arriving from Mexico fleeing persecution because of their faith during a period that was known as the Cristero War in Mexico when the Mexican state went to war with the Mexican Catholic Church. And that extends into the 1960s, migrant farm workers who turned to their churches to organize their labor unions and to boycott grapes to support migrant farm workers across the United States. And then, of course, maybe most dramatically in the 1980s with the birth of the sanctuary movement, where churches literally become places of safe harbor for political refugees fleeing fleeing persecution in El Salvador and Guatemala. And Milwaukee serves as a central hub for the sanctuary movement beginning in December of 1982 and extending all the way through the 1980s. And I think today we can still see this to this day, where Latinos turn to their churches for a number of different reasons. Again, as a place of solace, a place of fellowship, a place of faith, but also as a place of political mobilization.
Now, this is a book that was, in some ways, really born out of your desire to add to this history where there really wasn't a lot that was in a collected space. You start the book, of course, with a story about going to the library, asking for, you know, all the materials on Latino history in Milwaukee, and then finding a photo of yourself, of course.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a stunning story. You know, you have these existential moments when you say, am I doing what I'm supposed to be doing with my life? And my first experience in the archives as a young graduate student was to literally find myself in the first document that I pulled out of a box. It was, obviously hair-raising, and it kind of really shook me. But then I put my historian's hat on, and I got to thinking about a few different things. One, the fact that there was such a limited number of archives that have been preserved about my community. And I got to thinking, what does it mean that our historical societies, our libraries, our historians have done such a pitiful job of commemorating a history that I believe is central not just to our past as a state, but is fundamental to understanding where we're going as a state moving forward. And then I got to thinking, of course, what does it mean when I pull this first image out of the box? It was a picture of me and my parents and my family walking out of a church. And that really oriented my understanding of what it means to create community, right? Looking at these different institutions that can exist in many different varieties, not just as places of worship, but of social services and of political mobilization. I'm really fortunate today that I'm not doing this work by myself. There's a growing network of Latino historians across Wisconsin, across the Midwest, who are trying to put our region on the map, right? To say that, of course, we have to focus on the Southwest, in New York City, and Miami, where there are these large Latino populations. But the fastest growing Latino populations are in the U.S. South and the U.S. Midwest. And here in Wisconsin, of course, we can look at any number of urban areas or rural areas and know that absent Latino growth and absent Latino populations, we would see net demographic decline. And so we are literally the future of this state in so many different ways. It's imperative for us to look to the past, to rectify these archival accidents, archival problems, archival lackings, and fill them in with the histories of this community.
Well, I'm sure many people are very excited to read the book. I very much enjoyed it. Sergio, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thank you, Joy. I appreciate it.
Sergio Gonzalez is an assistant professor of history at Marquette University and the author of Strangers No Longer, Latino Belonging and Faith in 20th Century Wisconsin. The book was published yesterday, and Gonzalez will have an event at Boswell Book Company coming up on April 18th. There's a bit of a running joke here at WUWM about a story we did on the periodic table of elements. It's regularly one of the most visited stories on our website, even though the story was published back in 2019. That's when WUWM's Chuck Quernbach spoke to Bassam Shakashiri, an emeritus professor of chemistry at UW-Madison. He's an expert on the periodic table of elements and is known for his public presentations on science. He's also knowledgeable about the arts, science literacy, and particularly this year, science and politics. Chuck sits down with him again to talk about all of these things, and they begin with the connection between science and the arts.
I'm deeply interested, as many other people are, in creativity. Creativity in science, creativity in the arts, creativity in the humanities. And I'm interested in the intersections of these three areas. Most of my work, I would say maybe all of my work, has been dedicated and devoted to increasing the participation of young people, adults, older people, everyone, in matters that relate to being creative, but also be responsible. So in many of my programs, public programs, I have I have benefited from the participation of musicians and humanists. We've had young people from high school, some even middle school, participate in my Once Upon a Christmas Cheery in the Lab of Shaka Sheri. We did that for 50 years. So many different ways to encourage the development and growth in order to have everyone try their best to fulfill their human potential. That's my interest in the intersection of science, the arts, and the humanities.
So where does science enter into a musician's instrument or playing of it, or a painter's use of certain paints?
It enters in every way. We live in a chemical world. Everything around us is made of chemicals, and how we, our own bodies are made of chemicals. What goes on inside of our bodies is made of chemicals. So we need to understand how the beautiful sounds that musical instruments generate. What does the artist do, whether it's a string instrument or a wind instrument or any other musical instrument? How does it interact? What's it made of? Why is it that these substances and these combinations produce the beauty that we enjoy? So understanding how instruments are put together, how they work, contributes to our pleasure, contributes to our sense of understanding the complexity of the world that we live in.
Professor Shaka Sheri, one more question about the arts. The Oppenheimer movie recently picked up a bunch of Oscars. A lot of people have seen the film. What's the lesson from that movie regarding science?
There are many lessons from this movie. It's a movie. I enjoyed watching it. It is not only about science, it's about people who did science, who do science. It's about the connection of science with society. The last part of the movie, about maybe one third of it, has to do with what happened in Washington, D.C., in terms of the utility and the use to which we put science. I think it's very important for everyone to benefit from this film. Yes, it's been widely acclaimed, but as I said, it's not a documentary, it's a movie. It helps generate conversations about the use of atomic energy, atomic weapons in this case, and how we in society must be responsible in every action we take, every action we contemplate taking, about matters that relate to advances in science and technology. So if you haven't seen it, I urge you to see it.
You know, you speaking about these things fits into a broader mission of yours and other educators, promoting science literacy. What is science literacy?
Science literacy is the appreciation of science without a deep understanding of chemistry, physics, or biology, or any other science. It is an understanding and appreciation of what science is capable of achieving, and equally important, Chuck, what science cannot accomplish. Science literacy is necessary for the democratic process to work. We make great progress in our society. Science and technology are the engines that drive our economy. So we need to have a broad appreciation of science and its practitioners. It's very crucial that we understand that science literacy enlightens and enables people to make informed choices, to be skeptical. That's what we do in science. We make advances by being skeptical. And also to reject shams, quackery, unproven conjecture, and please to understand that we have to avoid being bamboozled into making foolish decisions where matters of science and technology are concerned. It's so important, especially in our daily lives and in our behavior, to understand what science and technology can do for us and how we can guard against bad misuses of science and technology. So science literacy basically is an attitude. If I may put it this way, it's like personal hygiene. We develop an attitude that affects our behavior. And our behavior, of course, influences our attitude.
Your use of words like quackery and bamboozling reminds me it's an election year. How should we apply science literacy to election year doings?
It's part of our responsibility as informed citizens to participate in the democratic process that we belong to, not misled by misinformation and disinformation, but to be responsible for our own personal good, but also, more importantly, for the common good.
Should we be asking a scientist to help us interpret some political claims this year?
Absolutely, yes. We should be engaged in meaningful, respectful conversations about all issues, issues that relate to science, issues that relate to technology, issues that relate to our well-being. We should all, everyone in society should engage in these conversations. Yes, ask all the questions that you want. Not that science has all the answers to our questions, but let us all engage in meaningful, respectful conversations. We respect each other as fellow human beings. We may not respect the ideas that people have, but we should listen to each other.
Another item in the news, our chat comes as some universities are making very tough decisions due to enrollment declines. Does high-level learning about science have to come through universities, or are there other ways?
Universities are an excellent source of science, science progress, and science literacy. But we can also learn from outside such institutions, especially now as we live in the electronic age. The electronic age is in its infancy. It's important that we develop the skill of sorting out the information that we get outside of a classroom or outside of a university. Well, we should do it inside as well, so that we are not misled, we are not misinformed. Yes, there is more reliance now on the internet, and with the emergence of artificial intelligence and with the use of electronic media to distribute information, we should sort out the information. We should exercise judgment about the validity of what we hear and what we learn so we can make good decisions.
A lot of talk this political year about apprenticeships and vocational training. Would you agree that science matters in the trades as well, the plumbers, electricians, and other very specialized people?
Science is for everyone, no matter what your profession is. Science and technology affect us in our daily lives. So yes, science and science literacy are for everyone in society. Professionals of all varieties, we all live together. We need to be getting along with each other peacefully. We need to be respectful of each other. And by learning science and how science works, we learn more about the world that we live in. We also learn more about the limitations of science and what answers science can give us. So not every question that we have as human beings is a question to be answered by science. And science is a dynamic enterprise. It changes. We learn more. As we learn, we should share. We should evaluate and assess what we learn.
It's sounding like you're optimistic about your science literacy goals.
I am very optimistic. I rely on the ingenuity of our listeners, of every human being, to engage in meaningful conversations about science and technology and about other matters in our society, too. I would like to see more conversations in the classrooms, outside the classrooms, at PTA meetings, the civic religious club meetings, everywhere, about the connectivity between what scientific and technological advances are and how we can use them for the benefit of humanity and for protecting our planet.
Bassam Shakashiri is a UW-Madison Professor Emeritus of Chemistry. He spoke with WUWM's Chuck Quernbach. Professor Shakashiri will be lecturing on the joys of sciences and the arts at UW-Madison on April 6th. And April 2nd is the spring election. You can have a say in our 2024 election coverage by filling out our election survey. You can find a link at WUWM.com. What you tell us will help inform the stories you hear on Lake Effect and WUWM. In about 15 minutes, we'll meet Milwaukee's first public artist in residence. But first, in our newest episode of Chirp Chat, we'll learn about the American Ornithological Society's decision to rename some birds. That's coming up next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Get ready to say goodbye to a lot of familiar bird names around Wisconsin. There's Cooper's Hawk, Wilson's Warbler, Franklin Gull, and dozens more. That's because the American Ornithological Society has vowed to rename all birds with English names. For this month's Chirp Chat, Lake Effect's Excret Nunez spoke with Jeff Galligan, the co-founder of the BIPOC Birding Club of Wisconsin. He explains the decision and how it's part of an effort to make birding more welcoming to everyone.
Last November, the American Ornithological Society announced its decision to rename all birds with English names. Could you help give me some background on this effort to rename birds? Is this initiative something people have been pushing for a while?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, the real movement on this issue and initial real pressure and focus on trying to get this done was made by a group called Bird Names for Birds. And they have a 2020 timeline because this is when all things kind of started happening. So on June 22nd, they sent a letter to the American Ornithological Society and the North American Classification Committee with 182 co-signers. And they were asking, or requesting more likely, they acknowledge the role eponymous common bird names played in perpetuating the effects of colonialism and racism in our country's past. And they had asked specifically that they indicate steps they would initiate to address this issue by middle of August of 2020. And on June 30th, the AOS released a statement after receiving their letter. It did not directly address bird names for birds and chose to focus on reviewing a single species, which was McCown's longspur. And this was because McCown was a slaveholder and he was a Confederate general. He was an amateur naturalist. The reason that that needs to be changed is because obviously his past is, again, it's clouded, much like John James Audubon. And so they chose to name this bird the thick-billed longspur. So they did one species. And they, Bird Names for Birds, acknowledged this move and expressed appreciation, but also that the issue still needs to be addressed, right? I mean, the whole issue of English names and honorifics and eponyms. So on August 20th, the Ornithological Society put out a statement saying they had just passed a council resolution regarding the English common bird names, and they agreed to work to find ways to make birding more inclusive and to develop strategies for addressing and dealing with English bird names. And this all happened in the span of that 1 year. And so now they've made the decision to start with 70 or 80 birds. I believe there's around 150 birds in North America that have English, common English names. So there's a lot to do, but I'm sure they're looking initially at the ones that are probably the most egregious, which there are plenty of them.
Right. I was going to ask, so, you know, as a co-founder of the BIPOC Birding Group and a BIPOC birder yourself, how do you feel about this decision by the AOS?
You know, I think the first thing we need to point out is that, you know, this decision will not end racism or EDI issues within the birding community. It's not going to do that at all, but it is a step in the right direction. And I think it's a fairly significant step, actually. I mean, I'm not going to take away anything from that. It's important. And that's in terms of acknowledging and addressing the racist and colonial past of our country and in bringing the intentional inclusion to birding for all people and for many reasons. And I think some of those are, first and foremost, this process is much like the whole Audubon name issue, which I'm a member of the Southern Wisconsin Bird Alliance, formerly Madison Audubon. And we went through that process last year of changing our name from Audubon because of these same issues with his past. He just wasn't a person fit for having something named after him. And so this process isn't part, you know, a righting of wrongs. You know, it's the acknowledgement and addressing of issue of naming birds after mostly white men, many with very sordid, troubling pasts. And I think that removing the name of those who have done egregious things is necessary, right? I mean, it's hard to say, ask people to come and join you in a birding outing or to join a society that's named after somebody who was a slave owner and return enslaved people, things like that. And I also believe it's an acknowledgement that we need all things outdoors to be truly inclusive and equitable. And they are not that right now. And it's a process. And I'm working on that myself on several fronts. And there is movement, which is positive. And I think that one of the big selling points of the American Ornithological Society is making is that birds need our help more than ever right now, especially songbirds. And by making this decision, it does pave the way for a more diverse birding community and more people who are really informed and concerned about the reduction in songbirds. And that's a very important thing. And we do need everybody on board with that. However, I don't want that message to be lost in the fact that the real issue needing addressing is being equitable and inclusive. And without addressing the past wrongs, we can't get to that point. So for that reason, it's a huge step.
Right. And something I want to touch on that you mentioned was this decision not only is making birding a more inclusive experience and acknowledging the wrongs of the past, but how is it going to help birders and scientists with identifying birds more accurately in the future?
Yeah, I think that names indicate a physical characteristic, right? Like, if you name a bird after something that is part of what it looks like or how it acts or its habitat, that might help new birders in narrowing down what it might be. I mean, I see that happening. I think that experienced birders and scientists are going to be fine because they already know the birds. They just have to get used to a new name. But I just really think this is more about making birding just a bit more welcoming to BIPOC and other populations traditionally excluded from the birding community, and thus attracting great minds from a relatively untapped resource. And that will benefit birds. So I think it's really more about how we can benefit birds overall by including all people and encouraging all people to be a part of the birding community, of acquiring the kind of knowledge that makes you concerned for what's happening, and then interested in supporting initiatives and organizations that are working to protect songbirds, whether it's through land acquisition, grassland restoration, things like that, you know?
Absolutely. Well, since we're diving deep into why the AOS made this decision, I want to go back to why we're even having this conversation. Why are names powerful? What power can names hold?
Yeah, I think, what I would like to see is them not hold any more power than to help identify a bird by something related to that bird with no consideration for humanity at all. I think where the power of a name, in especially in this case, comes into play is because the ties to our colonial and racist past, it's just, that's powerful. And that's sending a message by not dealing with that and not accepting or addressing the fact that to a lot of people that brings up painful memories and also a feeling of like people don't care enough to make this change. So how can I be involved in this community? Mm-hmm. So I think that's where the power is. And I think we can take that power away and that negative power away and just focus on what the bird does or acts like or lives.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I know the AOS is welcoming public input on its renaming process.
Yeah.
Do you have a bird name suggestion?
Well, the one that always comes into my mind, it's a simple one, is for the Wilson's Warbler to name it the black-capped warbler. I think that makes sense because it's a yellow bird with a very distinct black cap. So if you've never been out birding before and you see a yellow bird with a black cap and then see in the bird book, oh, look, there's a black-capped warbler, well, you're onto it then, I'd have to think about other ones like Cooper's Hawks, Steller's Jays, Bonaparte's Gulls, Bell's Vireos, Nelson Sparrows, LeConte Sparrows, you name them.
You were saying all of these names, and I wonder, who even are these people?
Yeah, who are these people? That's right. That's exactly right. And there's, on the website for Bird Names for Birds, there is a document that shows all of the honorific and eponymous names given to North American birds, and I think it includes Central America and the Caribbean, perhaps. But there's like 150 of them, but they talk about who they're named after and who named them, and there are some notes on some. But at least you got the name of who it's named after, and it's real easy to do a mild dive into who they are and figure out pretty quickly, what their past is. And I also just wish to point out that the argument that, like we're trying to erase history or change history, no, that's not it at all. What we're trying to do is shed light on it and then make the changes that we need to move on as a society in a much, much more a friendly, welcoming, inclusive environment.
Right. I appreciate that you mentioned that. So, as we previously mentioned, the AOS will start the renaming process this year by focusing on 70 to 80 bird species found in the U.S. and Canada. But what are some birds that can be found in the Wisconsin area that will be renamed?
Oh, boy, there's Wilson's Warbler is one. Cooper's Hawk is another really big one. We have Kirtland's Warbler, which is the rarest of warbler species in North America. Bonaparte's Gull, Bell's Vireo, Swainson's Thrush, Wilson's Snipe, Franklin Gull, LeConte Sparrow, Nelson Sparrow is another big one. So there's there's more. There's a lot more than that. But those are some examples.
Well, at the end of every Chirp Chat, I love for guests to shine a spotlight on a bird for the month. Is there a bird you'd like to highlight this month?
Oh, boy. Let's see. Okay, let's go, because we're doing an American Woodcock walk. And that's a bird that looks like it was made from, like, all of the leftover parts of mother birds, because nothing really looks like it belongs together. It's got a very long bill. It's got huge eyes. It walks kind of funny with a little, like, I don't know. It's got, like, it's dancing. It's really cool. They're a shore bird, but they live in forests, and they eat, you know, worms, things like that, and they're very secretive. And they blend very well. And so that's a great bird. And what I would like to tell people is that if they are nesting, which is coming soon, to really be careful not to disturb them. Because if they're disturbed off of their nest, many times they won't return to it. So it's important that we are cognizant of that in areas that they like to breed and nest.
Right. I'm thinking woodcock kind of is the shape of a Nerf ball, football.
It kind of is. Yeah, it really is. They're just the cutest little things. And yeah, they just look awkward, but they're real neat. And they do an amazing aerial dance. They do what's called painting right at dusk. And then they do these amazing aerial, the males will do these amazing aerial displays, usually about right after sunset. And they'll fly up several hundred feet even and do these crazy loops and then flutter back down to the earth, making this like chirping sound. And that's how they present for females. And it's really fun to go out and watch and listen to that.
That's so cool. So is this the season right now?
It's the season right now. Yeah, they're one of the first birds to come to make it back and to really get going. So.
Well, Jeff, thank you so much for speaking with me today and for helping break down this decision for our listeners.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me, Xcaret.
I know it's a tough conversation, but I think it really stems from our love and appreciation for birds.
That's exactly right. And wanting everybody to have that opportunity to experience it and benefit from that, from the known health benefits from being outdoors and listening to birds and listening to wind in the trees and the burbling of creeks. All that is very, very important for mental health and well-being.
Jeff Galligan is the co-founder of the BIPOC Birding Club of Wisconsin. He spoke with Lake Effect's Xcaret Nunez for a new monthly series we call Chirp Chat. At WUWM.com, you can hear more of this conversation and find last month's Chirp Chat all about how anyone can be a birder. A new season of Bubbler Talk is on the way, but ahead of that, we need some new questions. Submit your questions about the Milwaukee area at WUWM.com. Then listen for new episodes starting in May on Thursdays during Lake Effect and Fridays during Morning Edition. This summer, you'll start seeing something called an art car around Milwaukee. We'll tell you what that is next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Sarah Davitt is Milwaukee's first public artist in residence, a position created by the city in 2023 to address civic challenges in Milwaukee with creative artistic ideas. Davitt is in the middle of designing an art car, a truck rescued from a municipal tow lot that'll feature carvings of Milwaukee landmarks, traffic cones, and messages about traffic safety. The art car is scheduled to debut this summer, popping up at locations around the Milwaukee area to spark discussions about reckless driving. Davitt and the art car were featured in this month's Milwaukee Magazine, and Lake Effect's Sam Woods sits down with Davitt to discuss the art car and her goals for the project.
Can you talk about your work as the artist in residence and on the art car and what you hope people get from your creation?
So the general art car came across a lot of my experience with the Burning Man community. Art cars are actually how you get around out there, as aside from foot and bicycle traffic. Mm. And so having a lot of those ideas in the back of my head about mobile solutions for mobile problems. So if something is happening all over the city, how can you address that with a single mural in one place? How can you address that with a sculpture in one place? So how do you make it piece of art mobile? How can you set up that path to success for a solution that has the most impact over the greatest collection of populations? So I started with the idea of just covering this car in traffic cones and have later moved into carving the buildings of Milwaukee and the landmarks of Milwaukee onto these cones. So we have North Point Tower, we have the Basilica, we have a cone dedicated to River West 24. We have the bronze fawns is on there, as well as the P&H shovel out near the Miller Park. And then also we're carving the abandoned gas station on Wisconsin and 25th. Mm-hmm. There's things that people use to navigate the world, and they don't necessarily correlate directly to the skyline of Milwaukee. Yeah. And so the top of the car is going to be sort of all of these buildings rising out of sort of the lake. So we have the Hone Bridge on the front, and we have the beaches on the side. So it is a moving city by a lake. And while the proposal was about reckless driving, I prefer to talk about driving safety and driving skill rather than the alienation of the term reckless, that it is very othering. It is very it also allows you an excuse to sort of back out of that conversation because it's not about you.
Yeah. Like, I'm not a reckless driver. That's everyone else. Right.
Totally safe as I'm texting down the road and eating a sandwich at the same time. What does that look like? So anyway, how do you bring some of that conversation to all the people in kind of the middle, mm-hmm. who almost all the people who have to deal with driving challenges in on the road, is that there are people who are genuinely reckless, and there's people who would never answer the question, "I am reckless." So if you've come at a person in a vehicle, and you say, "Bikes rule, cars drool," or whatever that is, or, you know, "You should just get off the road. Nobody likes you anyway." Or, you know, "We're just going to shut down all your roads. Don't worry about it. It's fine." You know, like, what is that conversation going to do to that person? They're not going to want to talk to you again.
Yeah.
They're not going to care what you have to say.
Right.
Even though you may have the common ground. And in talking to a lot of the folks in the vehicle community and doing a lot of social media reviews, how do you look at those conversations in ways that say their common ground is, "Can we just not kill people today? That would be great."
Right.
And they're like, "Yeah, I don't want to kill people. I have never wanted to kill someone in my life."
Yeah, it sounds like the art car is meant to be a vehicle for conversation around, like, all right, how can we be better, and how can we each take a small step to being a better driver that hopefully adds up to safer roadways?
Right. And so it's, you know, how can you be a better driver? How can you be a better pedestrian?
Hmm.
How can you behave in a way that is more predictable? Hmm. Because it is the covenant of predictability that allows the road systems to operate the way that they do, with the reliability and functions that they do. If there isn't that predictability, if you are not operating within the general cultural norms of the space that you are moving through, will you cause people to have even tension, or just, you know, if you're deciding that you're in charge of the scenario, what does that mean?
Mm-hmm.
And how does that go? So,
yeah. Well, tell me about how your interest in this topic has evolved over time, because I'm guessing it wasn't you sent an application in to be artist in residence and then just started thinking about, you know, reckless driving, traffic safety.
Right.
So how has this evolved for you over time?
So some of the evolution comes from my involvement with the bicycle community out of Boston, specifically the Skull Bicycle Chopper Gang, the Subversive Choppers Urban Legion. They were chopping out bicycles and riding around in a phenomenal sort of moving community.
Mm-hmm.
They had radio stations that broadcast to other ships in the fleet because they're huge nerds, and yeah. that's delightful.
That's a fun thing to know about yeah. you know Biker Gangs is they're truly in their heart of hearts huge nerds.
Exactly. So we were building choppers. We were riding them every Saturday. They've been doing it for at least 30 years now, mm-hmm. Which is phenomenal. And also I was bicycle commuting every 6 years out there in the winter. Everything, all of that was being done. So I have a lot of bicycle perspectives, but then also my dad was a race car driver and also got heavily into motorcycles. So I remember being a young person, and he gave me a movie called On Any Sunday. And there was basically an entire blooper reel of that communicated why it was important to wear leathers, because you showed so many motorcyclists crashing
yeah.
and then skidding in a way that they were able to walk away from. Mm. And then also, you know, one of his big driving lessons for me was to take me out on a sheet of ice in the back parking lot and say, turn the wheel all the way to the left and now step on the gas. And when you feel like you're going to vomit, get out of it.
Jeez. Okay.
But that's a skill. Yeah. You have to learn to countersteer.
Yeah.
And you have to learn to kind of let... not freak out and slam on the brakes, or not freak out and slam on the gas. And that skill has stayed with me. You know, sometimes there's different ways you are driving a giant machine, and that is a skill.
Mm-hmm.
That is a skill that requires awareness, it requires engagement, it requires attention, it requires sometimes a lighter touch than you might normally if you kind of hold on too tight. You think you're controlling it, but you're actually the most out of control you could be.
How have these travels and conversations that you've had with people having to do with driving and transportation, and then of course your own driving lessons,
mm-hmm.
How have they helped you in this process of bringing people along with the ARCAR project?
So a good chunk of the most recent 10 years of my life has been operating in social change spaces and international development spaces, and so how do you understand that sometimes the relationships and the process is more important than the outcome of the product,
mm-hmm.
of the work.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you build those relationships so that those messages land in a softer, more receptive place?
Mm-hmm.
How do you get people to believe in your work who aren't your mother? You know, how do you get people to be open and receptive to the conversation? And sometimes that is by bringing in something that is completely ridiculous. This project will be ridiculous and delightful and amusing and hopefully insightful. And the conversations, I hope, will be more inclusive than I might normally expect.
Talk more about that approach and, as you say, kind of, you know, it's supposed to be ridiculous. You know, mm-hmm. The Milwaukee Magazine piece quotes you as saying that that this approach of using art to address, you know, reckless driving and traffic safety stands in contrast to punitive measures like fines and speed bumps. Why is this balance and this, you know, as you say, like ridiculous approach mm-hmm. important?
So when you talk about people who have sort of lived with a tremendous amount of trauma from loss, from fear, from just general tension from walking through the day, I spoke to one person who said, I'm feeling this road, and I'm feeling just the tension and anger that's coming from this road.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of said, hold up, we have to sort of unpack that a little bit and think about what would that do to your ability to navigate this road effectively? If you approach your environment, your neighborhoods, your space with fear, what does that mean? How do you get people who are feeling as if, because their neighborhoods are dangerous, how do they get from A to B as fast as they can? How do they get from there in a way that allows them to feel in control of this one thing that they normally might not feel in control of anything else in their life? That if they can't control their income, their money, their housing, their situation, all that thing, in this moment behind this wheel, I'm in control of this one thing. So how can you bring some of that message and alleviate that fear with a sense of skill and an attentiveness to how that all can make us all better drivers, or even just conflict management? because if you see someone behaving poorly on the roads, you will find people who will like try and like cut you off extra just to prove you were wrong or teach you a lesson or do something like that, when really the proper response is just let it go. If you feel unsafe, exit the road until you feel safe again.
Yeah.
You know, how can you teach that? That's a skill.
Yeah.
To recognize that this situation is unsafe and I am completely and totally within the agency to leave that situation.
So I want to close with what's next? When and where can we see this? Can we see this art car in action?
Mm-hmm. So you should definitely keep an eye out for it this summer. Hopefully it will attend block parties. Hopefully it will attend even just kind of casual conversations, just park down by the lake and let people come to those conversations and engage with the piece and find all the Easter eggs and the secrets that I've buried into the whole project.
Well, Sarah, thank you so much for joining me on Lake Effect. I appreciate your time.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Sarah Davitt is the City of Milwaukee's first public artist in residence. She spoke with Lake Effect Sam Woods. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of today's conversations, or if you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll learn how the library can help you learn about your family history. That's tomorrow at noon, right here on Lake Effect, on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.